Today's show is brought to you by our presenting sponsor, Cufflinks.com. Cufflinks.com has been with us this entire season. We cannot thank them enough. Thank you, Cufflinks.com. And everyone listening, you can thank Cufflinks.com. Just head on over to Cufflinks.com/DVR. Check out their amazing products. If you have an event coming up, if you want to have just amazing matching Game of Thrones, Marvel, DC, NBA, or hey, all the finest products and finest makers that you can find, go to cufflinks.com and use the code GOT20 to get 20% off your order today on any Game of Thrones products. Elevate your style. Dress for success. Go to cufflinks.com/DVR today. Welcome back to Podcast Winterfell. Wow. What a special episode we have today. We're going to be talking about all things Game of Thrones. I've got two great guests. Before I do that, though, I just want to tell you, you can go to podcastwinterfell.com. You can go to dvrpodcast.com. We are going to continue podcasting. Once this series ends, we'll be back for the prequel, sequel, mini-series, webisodes, whatever they do. I'm going to even read the books, and we're going to cover other things like Big Little Lies with Jenny. I'm going to be doing that on DVR Podcast, Daily DVR. Check that out. Enough about me, though. I've got two very special guests. I've got the creator of the podcast, Matt Murdock, here. Matt, say hello, please.
Oh, it's great to be back. A second time in a whole week. I don't know. It feels like home again. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it always is home, baby. And on the other line, I have the Bardster himself. It's Ken, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, Ken.
Thanks so much for having me, Axel. Matt, it's great to be on with you. It feels like old times.
It certainly does, man.
Yeah, it really does feel like old times. It feels like, you know, 4 years ago, like right now.
Can you believe it? We're headed into the end here. So this is just a great group. We're going to chat today about a whole host of things. Actually, we don't really even have notes or anything. We're just going to chat. We're going to let it take us where it takes us. But the one thing I did want to check in on is Matt and I have our podcast. We talk for hours each week. But Ken, we have not heard from you since episode 2, when you and I did the initial reaction, I believe, right?
That's correct.
So yeah. Please, Ken, episode 3, 4, and 5 and headed into the end game. Take it away. Please tell us what you've been thinking about, any points you want to discuss, anything at all. The floor is yours, my friend.
Well, I felt the same way pretty much this entire season, which is that it continues to be a deconstruction of traditional genre storytelling. Just like the pilot was, like, you know, the pilot was basically like arguably from Bran's point of view. And then at the end of that episode, he gets pushed out a window, presumably to his death. And that was shocking. And it was shocking when you read it in the books too. And this story continues to be that way. And I guess I've thought that the last few episodes have been bleakly beautiful, depressing, but beautifully so. Emotional is a word that comes to mind. I thought the Battle of Winterfell was beautifully directed. I thought this last episode on Sunday, The Bells, was also beautifully directed. There were some shots that I'll never be able to get out of my head ever. They were that beautiful. And I thought some of these really like conversations between two or three people have been glorious. Like, that's why I fell in love with Game of Thrones. And that's the thing that continues to bring me back week after week, season after season, is all of these complicated characters with complicated relationships coming together and often having these really small, intimate conversations amidst all of this sort of magic and fantasy and hoopla and battles. And so I guess that's what I've thought about the last few episodes. I've loved it. It's been a ride. I mean, I don't know if I would change it as far as the TV show goes. You know what I mean? Because, like, yeah. I'm a book reader But to me, it's always been apples and oranges. Like the books are one journey and the TV show has been a completely different journey. And as far as the TV show goes, I feel like it's going exactly the way it probably should go. And if I don't like certain things, that just tells me how invested I am. Mm-hmm. And if my heart breaks, it's because these actors have put their hearts and soul into these performances. Mm-hmm. And Dan and Dave and all the writers have done a great job steering the ship all these years. So I want my heart to break. Like, I want to be that invested in a television show that I yell at the TV screen. So it's been great.
That is awesome. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And I mean, that's what I pretty much, knew also from chatting with you. And I think your perspective on the books is one that, even though I haven't read them, I've always shared, and it's two different things, you know, and you can have an investment in, you know, it's as I like to say, a lot of our society and life and culture and fandom has become an either or proposition. You either like it or you don't. When I think really nothing is really an either or proposition. That's kind of like a false dichotomy. You can like them both. You can have problems with them both. You know what I mean? It's like they're two separate things. And I like your perspective on that. Has there been anything, Ken? There's been some obviously big things like Arya taking out the Night King, Cersei and Jaime, like all these things that have happened. Has there been one in particular that you were super excited about and one that maybe you're like, I expected something different. I accept it, but I expected something different.
I've always thought, and you and I've talked about this before, Axel, and I've thought about this a lot the last few years, that the story is really about power and about the character's relationship with power. So the one scene that comes to mind that I feel like crystallizes maybe the entire story is the one just this last Sunday night between Arya and the Hound. It was perfectly written, brilliantly acted. But like in a meta point of view, I feel like Arya made a choice, and she made a choice that Cersei and the Hound and the Night King and Daenerys didn't make. Like, she made the completely opposite choice than what those characters did. She chose to walk away. And so I felt like that scene and her decision in that scene, and then juxtaposed with the choices that other characters were making often in the same episode, I thought that sort of crystallized the entire story for me. And I thought it was beautiful. Like, it made me cry. Like, it brought tears to my eye, not only because of the scene itself, because of the relationship between Arya and the Hound, but also just what it signified to me made me emotional. So
I love that, Ken. I as you well know from our years of talking together, I've always been one that fretted and worried and scraped and screamed and shook my fist at the fact it's like, they're turning Arya into this cold-blooded killer. And I feel, as I put on the Monday podcast, I was just kind of like, I was so relieved. And it's not like it just came out of nowhere. Right. Ever since she returned, or the end, let's say the end of season 7, through this entire season, she has begun to re-embrace her humanity. And I loved that. I love this journey that Arya went on. So that's a great one to point out.
I actually thought about you, Matt, when that scene was like in the middle of the scene. I specifically thought about you because I thought about all like what you just referenced, all of our conversations about how much you worried about, you know, Arya turning into like a soulless Terminator and, you know, losing her humanity. And in that moment, she had a choice, and she could have so easily have followed the Hound out of that courtyard. And the fact that she didn't is beautiful, and it says so much about her, and it's so hopeful in an episode that was otherwise not particularly hopeful in lots of other ways. Right. But like that moment was super hopeful, not only for the Starks in general, but kind of Arya specifically. which is great.
Ken, I think that was freaking beautiful, man. I love that you said that, and I'm getting chills just thinking about it, because then when you think about what we then watch Arya go through after making that decision, right?
Yeah.
And I've been saying, I did 10 podcasts already this week, and I was so focused on the line when the Hound was like, look at my face. You don't want to be like this girl. And then later she looks exactly like him after going through. And it was kind of, to me, it was more about how like he can't protect her. Like these older, just in the same way that this younger generation, so much of this story has been about how they'll correct the faults of this older generation, which they have in many ways not been able to do. And in a lot of ways, they just fall victim to the same things because they are, in a sense, even though they're godlike mythical creatures, human, their humanity shines through, which is another part of the story, right? Magic humans. Right. But the portion that you're talking about there, that Arya as kind of a representative of this newer generation, and also, by the way, the hardest one. You know what I mean? Like the thing that I've always liked, Matt, and when I would hear you talk about the Arya character, and I would agree with you, but then I'd also think to myself, but at least they're making her the baddest ass. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
They're not half-assing this. She's not going on with the Hound and like Pod learning a little sword fighting. You know what I'm saying? No, she's becoming a assassin, a magical ninja-like warrior, can jump from anywhere, do anything, waif-like assassin who prays to literally to the god of death. It's as hard as you can get. It is heavy metal, baby, right? So for her to be the one that turns away, that learns that lesson, is just as beautiful as you said, Ken, and that really hits home with me.
I have another hot take about both last Sunday's episode and maybe the season in general, and maybe even season 7 too. There's been a lot of talk, including in my own head, about Tyrion, and you and I, Axel, have talked about what's going on with Tyrion, and you know why is he making all of these quote unquote mistakes? What happened to the guy who could like talk himself out of anything? But then I thought this morning, I was thinking about this, and I thought, you know, maybe in some weird way, he's doing the same thing that Arya did in that scene with the Hound. Like, I kept thinking about that scene with Jaime in the tent, which was also super emotional for me, as I'm sure it was for a lot of people. And then I thought about what he said to Shay after the Battle of Blackwater, when she was like, let's go to Braavos, let's go to Pentos, let's get away from these people, let's just, you know, live happily ever after, in effect, you know, let's go off and like live our lives and just be in love. And he said no to her. And I wonder if he regrets that now. I wonder if if acknowledging his emotions more, if protecting his brother Jaime in that moment was him not doing what that old Tyrion would have done. Has he lost his edge? Possibly, probably. But is he more human now? Absolutely. And that may not help him in the short term, but I'm thinking more and more that him embracing his humanity more and maybe letting go of more and more quote-unquote cleverness, maybe it suits him better for the long term.
I love that thought. I really do. I think for me, and this is the change that I've seen over Tyrion, when we saw him being clever, when we saw him doing things to move things around, a lot of that was self-motivated. It was motivated in service of self. He was trying to survive being the hand of the king, the hand of the worst king. Sorry, Bubba. I know you're probably listening, but the hand of the worst king ever. Yeah. And he was doing a lot of things in terms of self-survival. When it became about him, once it kind of culminated with his father and him killing his father and having to run away from that, I think, and we can say whether it was a mistake or not to endorse it, Danny. Obviously, she's done a terrible thing. I don't think of her as mad. I just think of her as angry and desperate, and she did a terrible thing. I hope upon hope that we see a little bit of remorse for that. But even if we don't, we can look at it from a Tyrion perspective and say he really threw his weight behind something that he thought was good for everyone.
Yeah.
As opposed to the earlier seasons where he was doing a lot of things that was just kind of good for himself.
I absolutely – like, that's a great point, Matt. And so much of his early arc, you're right, was absolutely self-serving. And it's ironic that maybe the audience has a more complicated relationship with Tyrion now versus those days where he maybe was more wheely-dealy, self-serving, but much – easier to get behind because it's much easier to root for someone like the underdog like that who's sort of looking out for themselves and winning. And this sort of emotional ground that he's in now is a lot more complicated and muddled. And I think for the first time in his life, he's sort of going moment to moment thinking, what is the right thing to do? Big picture. And I think he's looking at a big picture that maybe he's never looked at before, which makes his decision making a lot more complicated.
I like what you said, Ken, about how maybe he should have just ran off with Shay. That was, you know, Keith and I were talking about it. And I love Tyrion. I'm wearing a Tyrion t-shirt right now. I love the actor, the character. But I don't love where he is now, and that's because it's a sad place, and I think you're right. He is just, you know, I mean, look, whenever you hate something, you love it. And even though he hated his family, he hated them because they didn't accept him, and he loved Jaime because he did. Yeah. So it's not like he said, you know, Jamie, you and Cersei and Dad were dead to me when I was 14, and I realized you were never going to love me or accept me, and I moved on with my life. No, that's not what happened. He continued to seek their approval until the last dying day when he killed his father because of what he had done to him, you know? And yeah. I think that it's a sad thing, and we want Tyrion to be this laughing, jolly guy. And a lot of people say, oh, remember, he was so funny a couple seasons ago. Well, hey, if you had seen all this death and destruction and trauma across several continents, you might not be so happy either. And you might be drinking just to get away from it. Yeah. And I think that's really where Tyrion's at. And I worry for him in this final episode. I worry especially for Tyrion and Sansa, because Dany has basically name-checked them like she name-checked Varys, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, he probably would be better off just going off into a pub and hanging out and maybe finding a nice woman and settling down and just, you know, being the guy who tells the war stories at the local pub every night. But unfortunately, you know, there may be a different destiny in store for him.
Well, go ahead, Ken.
I think that's going to be the conversation, right? Like, what... like who is going, like what side of this argument is going to be the apparent victor at the end of next week's episode? Like, is it going to be the people who have embraced humanity and taken a step away from power? Or is it going to be power itself that has sort of engulfed these other characters? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's where we're heading, just generally speaking, in the final episode, is like, what worldview is going to prevail in the final episode?
Love that. And I, as far as worrying about Tyrion, of course, we should all be worrying about Tyrion because, as you said, he's been name-checked by Daenerys. For me, the biggest and probably the most moving encapsulation of the journey of his character was his line to Jaime. You know, what's, you know, tens of thousands of innocent lives versus the life of one not so innocent dwarf. I can't even imagine him saying something like that in season 3, you know, and because of that, it seemed to me that he's already accepted whatever fate's being handed to him. But to what end will he do something about that, I think, is going to be the most interesting thing about this upcoming episode.
The other thing that George and now Dan and Dave have so brilliantly done is, like, when you think about the Lord of the Rings characters, they stay somewhat static through the entire story. I mean, there's a little bit of narrative. There's narrative evolution, which has no choice but to affect the characters and their choices. But, like, a lot of the supporting characters are the same exact person, nearly speaking, at the end of the story that they were at the beginning of the story.
Yes.
With some slight alterations. What George has done here is he's, like, taken the idea of a character arc and multiplied it times 100. And so I understand that some people are, like, are uncomfortable and maybe unhappy, because growth means change and it means evolution. And sometimes that takes people and characters into directions that are unexpected or unwanted by certain viewers, readers, viewers of a television show. So I completely understand the tension that some people feel, have felt the last few years, because characters have grown sometimes in ways that make them seem unrecognizable to certain viewers. But to me, that's sort of the genius of the story, right? That, because that's what happens in real life. We change, we evolve, and sometimes we look in the mirror and we think, who is that person? And I kind of feel like that's what's happening in this story.
Love that. Love that a lot. Let me flip it though to another Lannister, and that is Jaime, who I don't like to think of Jaime as, I know a lot of people are complaining about the whole thing in regards to Jaime is, you know, he built up this character arc where he was redeeming himself. I don't see him as not as unredeeming himself through this action of his. I actually see him as, it's like Cersei is his heroine, you know, and that's just something that he just could never get over.
I would have been much more disappointed had he decided to go fight for Cersei or kill for Cersei.
Right.
And that isn't what he decided to do at all. I think he knew that she was going to lose. I think he had an inkling that she may die. And I think he just wanted to be with the person that he loved most in the world at the end of the world. I think that's all he wanted. Mm-hmm. I don't think he wanted to fight for her cause. I don't think he wanted to do her bidding. Like that, you're absolutely right, Matt. That would have been unredemptive. But the fact that he just wanted to be with the person he loves most in the world and that he came into the world with, I think that's completely in keeping with his character. And even with all of the evolution and changes that positive changes that have happened to him over the course of the story, it makes total sense that he would want to be with her at the end of the world.
Yep, I agree completely.
Oh, sorry, guys. I had the wrong thing turned down. So what happens when we're all trying to be nice and be muted for a second. I muted the wrong mic. I like what both of you are saying about Jaime. And, you know, I guess, though, I'm not so sure. I think sometimes maybe we get caught up in the ways that a story can be told and almost trap the author, showrunner, or whatever in having to complete a predetermined idea of what a arc or redemption story or earning something is, right? And sometimes I think that can take away the value of a really well-rounded, three-dimensional, sometimes unpredictable character, or a character who makes a sudden realization, as we often do in life. I mean, we were talking before we got on about life choices and stuff, and sometimes you just, something happens and you realize something. And I think that Jaime, having never slept with anyone but Cersei, I mean, it's like this. In my life, when I had a girlfriend and we were in love and we broke up, it happens. Then you sleep with another girl or guy or whatever, and all of a sudden you're like, you kind of think about that other person. You know what I'm saying? Like that act, which you only shared or shared with them for so long, reminds you of them And I think that's what happened to Jamie. It's like, you know, you break up with your girlfriend, you sleep with another girl, you wake up and you go, oh, damn, what did I do? Now I realize that I actually, that was not as meaningful to me as I thought it was. And unfortunately for Brianne, that's kind of probably what happened, is he realized that he really loved Jamie, and also with Sansa laying the Littlefinger line on him. But it was like, maybe it's not so much about his redemptive arc as it is, he just always was this guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's just, and we just had to get to know him, and he had to get to know himself, but he just always was a guy that was capable of a grand knight-like gesture of saving Brienne and losing his hand because of it, and also pushing a kid out a window.
Yeah.
That's just who he is. He's not one or the other. He's not a good guy. He's not a bad guy. He's Jaime Lannister.
And what's great is he even has, I mean, he says that exact same thing to Catelyn Stark, at the end of season one, Matt?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Where he says, I'm no one but me, basically. Yeah.
And Ken, that's a theme that you touched on all throughout your podcast, is the codes of these characters. And to me, Jamie never once ever broke his code. He did what was necessary, what he thought was right or necessary at the time for what, not just what he wanted, but just what he felt was needed. Sometimes that ended up in terrible acts, like throwing a kid out a window. Sometimes that ended up in fantastic acts, like stabbing a king in the back. Either way that you want to look at it, he's always been a good person who does bad things, or a bad person who does good things, or somewhere in between.
Yeah. Yep.
Absolutely. Well said. Well said.
Jaime Lannister. But I will say one thing, guys. This season, and you know, I've been very positive, and I think we all are positive about enjoying the season. One thing I have been a bit perplexed by, and I'm not sure why the choice was made. And I think in essence, it for me, it's a thing that's missing from this season, and it's Cersei. We're talking about Jaime, and I feel like Cersei spent so much time looking out a window. And I know that I can justify this by basically, you know, she kind of blew her load by, like, why do I keep on saying blow the load on this pod? I don't know why I keep on saying it on the podcast. I got to stop saying it. Okay. She kind of used a lot of her energy as a character, and then she just kind of attained this, like, dark mother role. The pregnancy thing happened, which, by the way, Ken, I guess she really was pregnant. And how much did that really play into it? I don't know. Maybe you all could help me with that. If you saw something in Cersei's character, or even her arc, or what she just did this season, I was left a little desiring more from Cersei. And maybe it's just because I love Lena Headey so much. R.I.P. Sarah Connor Chronicles. But I just wish there was more Cersei.
You know, I don't disagree with you, especially from a performance point of view, because I love the work that Lena has done over the years as well. In fact, if I was hard-pressed, I might say that she has consistently been the finest actor on Game of Thrones.
That's how I feel.
And turned in the most consistently wonderful, electrifying, complicated performances of any of the actors, and they're all fine actors for sure. But she seems to be at like the top of the heap. Like if you look at the entire series, the only other person who I felt that way about while she was on the show was Michelle Fairley, who while she was on the show, I thought she was the finest actor on the show.
Oh my God. I'm still haunted by her. Remember, I counted it out on the rewatch. I think the scream was like 30 seconds long or something like that. And the Red Wedding.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like, oh God.
So I've been missing the performance, but I think that when Jamie walked away from her at the end of last season, her arc was effectively over because she had driven everyone away. She had made a series of self-destructive choices that she thought were going to get her what she wanted. And at and when Jamie walked away from her at the end of last year or 2 years ago, I feel like that was effectively the end of her story. And I think that's, I think from a narrative point of view, it's really brave to take a character like Cersei and say her character's arc is over. She just doesn't know it yet. And I feel like, and I could be wrong, but I feel like that's what they've been doing with Lena Head, with Lena this year and that character this year, because she's definitely been a shadow of herself. There's no denying that. But there's got to be a reason for it. And I think it's because when Jamie walked away from her, that was the last straw. That was it. And the curtain came down for her.
I would add to that, to me, thematically, along with George's books, and, you know, people are saying that, you know, George may or may not do this, may or may not do that. I honestly feel like if you look seriously through George's books, you find very few white hat, black hat characters. Yeah. And essentially, like you said, Ken, when Jaime left Cersei, there was nothing left to wear for her except a black hat. And the show, I think, appropriately pulled a lot of focus away from her for that very reason, so that we could explore what is Jaime going to do, so that we could explore how is Arya going to grow, so that we could explore all of these other things, because that's what's important. The characters that are in movement, whereas Cersei's character had reached a point where you couldn't develop it any way or another until the end, which I felt was very brought. Lena was fantastic in this last episode. She brought it back to me. I know we want to hear cries of remorse or what have you. That when she was standing and watching everything being destroyed around her, and Qyburn finally said, "We have to go. We have to go to Maegar's Holdfast. You can't stand here anymore." And she began to cry. That said everything to me about Cersei's regret right there, and that was good enough for me.
Or even like a continuation of that emotion, Matt, was when they were both down in the cellar and realizing that, you know, they were trapped and that it was over effectively. The fact that she turned into a scared little girl, a scared, vulnerable girl in the arms of the man she loves. I mean, I'm not ever going to forget that moment and that performance and the chemistry between those two actors. And also, I'm never going to forget that a big bad of the show at the end of her life was just a scared girl in the arms of the man she loved. I think that says, I think you're right, Matt. It says everything you need to know about the complexity of that character, but also how much that character had lost.
Yes.
Guys, can you hold on a second? Because I just have to send out the Hangout link to all the people on Twitter who are upset about the show so you can convince them eloquently why they shouldn't be. So just give me just 15 minutes to do that. I just have to – wait, Twitter reply all. Okay. Because you just – you convinced me. And you know what? Matt, you just put it into Ken, you set it up, and then Matt, you brought it home. She became the Night King. There was no reason to know what the hell she was doing. She became just a force of nature. You're right. She was just utterly the black hat, the bad guy, the bad gal. And just like with the Night King, she is just in essence a like I was saying, a force of nature. She is no, she kind of gave up her humanity. Right. Yeah.
And that was one of the things that was the most beautiful about it, Axel, was to see her regain that when it was all over.
That's how you brought it home, buddy. And you guys were talking about the end when she becomes just a scared child back to the, and like I've been saying, and I'll say it again, back to the womb of fire for the brothers, the womb of fire, the womb of stone, of rock, like their hearts, for the brother and sister, the incestuous twinsters, Wonder Twin Incest powers activate. Form of a fall and what falls on them? How more metaphoric can it be? The castle, right? The seed of power is what crushes them.
Don't make me go for the bad pun, but it was a casserly kind of rock.
I love it. It does. See, that's what I mean. You know, guys, it's fun to discover these things in the writing, and though things may not only always turn out the way we want, when we look into the text, and in many ways, when I say text, the TV show is a text too. It provides us with the opportunity to see things like this and see that, unfortunately, Ken, like we talked about a lot before too, and I know Matt, man, you've talked about it endlessly, just the trauma that these characters have gone through and the suffering, like we saw in this particular episode, of the little people and through Arya's journey through that. But I'd like to ask you all a bit here about John and how responsible he is for this too, because a lot of people are saying Dany is a mad queen. She went crazy, the bells, and I do have a perspective from a filming point of view, from a more a production standpoint, how they maybe could have communicated this a little bit less towards the crazy lady side and more towards the mocking. And I have to do this again. I went through this in Marine. I went through this, you know, I'm just trying to help and nobody wants me to help. You know what I mean? Like if they had done a little more of that, like I liked how in the coming on this week, they had all the voices playing in Danny's head. And Heath and I were saying, if they had done that in the show in some way, contextually with sound effect, with something like that, it may have added to the audience's understanding of what she was going through. But the thing that a lot of people aren't talking about is how it seems like everyone around her failed her, including John. You know, he just didn't even take into consideration all that she had lost and their whole scene when he can't kiss her. And I just like to talk a little bit about maybe, you know, it takes two to tango, as my mom used to say. Matt, what do you think about John's kind of responsibility in this and how he's reacted to this news of his lineage and all that?
Well, I do believe that John, no matter who he knows that he is, still is probably mostly who he has always been. I don't see him learning his lineage, changing anything about how he is. And he was brought up in, you know, he was brought up in Winterfell. He's brought up in a place where incest is not cool, you know. So in terms of his reaction to Dany, I think that's just an instinctive after years and years of just feeling terribly about this. He just can't be with her the same way that she wants. And John's truest fault is the fact that he's the last one. Dany already doesn't trust Tyrion. She can't trust Varys. She has executed him. I can't remember what the order is now. She's lost Jorah. She's lost Missandei. She's got a warrior in Grey Worm who will just follow her orders. And without anybody to counsel those orders, then, you know, she can rely on him to carry out whatever she asks for. You know, she says, you'll know when it's time or what have you. And that may have been about her attacking the Golden Company. It may not have been. It may have been about a deeper thing. And I don't want to get into that. But I just want everybody to know that I don't blame John. I think that John is just being John in the same way that he couldn't tell Cersei that he would bend the knee to her, in the same way that he had to tell his family. And these events are things that contribute indirectly, perhaps, to Daenerys's turn. But it's Dany's own sense of isolation and her anger about that isolation, to me, is what causes this to happen in this last episode.
To build off that, I agree with everything you just said, Matt. And just to build off that, I would only add that John has never been great at politics. He wasn't great at politics when he was Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. Excellent. He completely misread that room. He misread multiple rooms. not that they were right to do what they did to him, but he did not see that coming. And, you know, Sansa would have seen it coming. So he's not a politician. He's like Ned Stark Redux. Like, the worst thing Ned did was allow his friendship with Robert to draw him down south, because Ned had no business in King's Landing. John had no business being Knight Commander or Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. And he has no business in politics ever. Mm. So I guess I would just add that he's bad at it, and that, and not only is he bad at it, but whether he knows it or not, he hates it. And I think he knows it. Yeah. I feel like I know the ending of John's story. Like, I don't even have to see it next week. Like, in my mind, I can clearly see the end of his character, like what's going to happen to him. And I think it's been alluded at, particularly through a conversation with Tormund 2 weeks ago. And so I feel like breaking the wheel for John probably means that maybe he realizes how bad he is at this, and maybe he walks away from it all.
Love that.
I've become a big fan of that. Matt, I think I heard maybe you say, I can't even remember all the podcasts I listen to now, but I've heard people say that, Ken, and I'm a fan of that idea now too. But I just think that, gosh, guys, I don't know, maybe it's in the, you know, I keep on drawing back to, like, calling John like a Hamlet-like character in situations, and I feel like he is. I don't know, you know, you're there with this, with the woman, and I guess there's, you know, the weight of the war, and I think he's kind of scared of her too, honestly. I think that's a thing, is that, you know, people like Jorah and Dario and Missandei, they had a view of Dany. They kind of saw her come up, and they saw her fail in other ways too. And maybe she felt that she could be a bit more herself around them, or they could treat her in a way where they weren't always scared of the Dragon Lady. And John just, you know, I do think it's the way the scenes are acted, you know, that he is so hesitant, and he keeps on just saying to her, yes, my queen, look, falling back, like you're saying, on that Ned stuff, right? Instead of dealing with the real emotion, at like he was with the grit, you know, where he could just kind of be himself, and where he was with Dany for just a couple of scenes that we saw in the boat at the dragon pit, even when they went to the little water fountain, the waterfall this season, where they felt, where, like I was talking about, I could feel like two people with great power could take off their uniforms and kind of be together. And Dany is almost trying to do this in the last scene. She's like testing him, you know, like even when she kisses him, it's like forceful. And when he doesn't kiss her back, she keeps on trying to kiss him for, you know, and I don't know, maybe it's even the sexual politics of Dany being kind of a more open sexual person, and John having been a dude who has been with one lady who very much dominated him, you know, and he's just, are they trying to say something about that too? I don't know, but.
I think that over the last generation or so, we've romanticized the reluctant hero as an archetype.
Yeah.
And I think one of the geniuses of the many genius things that George has done here is that he's shown us the reality of a reluctant hero, the frustrating aspect of a reluctant hero, the contradictory choices of a reluctant hero.
Yeah.
And so, because when you're a reluctant hero, that means there's some indecisiveness baked into that, and there's some obtuseness baked into that, because you're reluctant. So I think George, above and beyond everything else he's done, has shown us the true, quote unquote, nature of a reluctant hero. Like, you want a reluctant hero? I'll give you a reluctant hero. And it's frustrating and maddening sometimes. But I agree with you, Matt. John has always been true to himself, and that is that he's a reluctant hero.
Yes.
And so I think that that can look ugly here, but but I think that's sort of that's the genius of it.
Wow. Matt, Ken, and me, what a podcast. These guys are awesome. I hate to interrupt, but I must remind you to go to cufflinks.com/DVR today. Dress for success. Hey, you got a graduate coming? People are graduating, high school, kindergarten. Hey, even my kindergarten, my kid wears cufflinks. Go to cufflinks.com. College, go to cufflinks.com/DVR today and get amazing products from cufflinks.com. You can even use the code GOT20 if you want to get some Game of Thrones products. And remember, we are giving away a pair of amazing Targaryen cufflinks. All you need to do is email us at podcastwinterfell@gmail.com and tell me what your favorite moment of the entire series is. Your favorite moment of the entire series. I'm going to do a whole podcast where I read everybody's favorite moments, and at the end of it, I'm picking out of a hat and you're winning the cufflinks. So it's going to be a total fan experience. Maybe I'll even do it live on YouTube. Who knows? Things could get crazy around here. Go to cufflinks.com/DVR. today. Yeah, that's a great point, Ken. He is reluctant, but the frustrating part is sometimes he's badass too, you know, and that's what makes these characters so great. Is I think back, and when you talk about him kind of walking away from it all, in that line with Tormund, when Tormund says, "You have the real North in you," I think that's the line.
Yeah.
And plus, that ghost is going up there and he has to give him a proper hug and little pet him.
yes, like, he does.
That's what's going to happen is we're going to have like this triumphant scene and John is about to like kill the dragon or kill Danny. And then all of a sudden a little like comic thought bubble is going to appear above his head and it's going to be Ghost going, mm-hmm. And he's going to go, "Ghost." And he's just going to walk. That's just going to cut to black, Tony Soprano style. Everybody would cheer for that. Actually, all the people upset would be happy now.
All I know is he better have the best doggy treat ever that reunion.
I know, right? That's gonna have to be a big leg of something, a big rack of lamb. But I can see that, because one of his triumphant moments, Ken, was when he killed the people who killed him. Took off his coat and said, "My watch is ended." Yeah. And everybody was kind of like, "Hell yeah, Jon Snow, you know, you do you." So he does have it in him. And, you know, Battle of the Bastards, many other times, you know, he stands up for things. So this is going to be a real test for him. But I still have to say, I feel like he failed Danny. I will feel like that. If I had to write a dissertation on Jon Snow, I would say one of the mistakes he made is he wasn't there for her.
I think technically you're absolutely correct. I just I don't know if it was intentional or not. That's for sure.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I think he's in his feelings. I don't think he's trying to be mean or he's completely absconding. He thinks he's making a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's just ignoring the real choice.
Well, he's a reluctant hero. He's a reluctant boyfriend as well.
He's a reluctant boyfriend.
He's just flat reluctant. Let's start calling him King Reluctant, first of his name.
I know. We got to get a Blue Chews ad on this podcast. You know, he's too reluctant. Did anybody get that joke?
Yes.
All right. Hey, Matt, is there anything you want to bring up, buddy?
Actually, you know, I've talked so much this week. I am so fascinated by what Ken is saying. And fortunately for me, I feel like I've grown enough as a fan to where I agree with him on everything as opposed to before. There would be times I'd argue with Ken over the stupidest points. And thank goodness I've passed that grade now, at least.
Oh, well, hey.
I can remember all of the disagreements we had about Daenerys, like season two, season three, like, because you were like, what is the point? What is this girl doing? Like, why is she doing this? And oh my gosh. Yeah. You and I have had many, many conversations about this story and about the way we see it. It's been great. You know, Matt, I know you just said that you're sick of talking, but of course I have some questions for you now. Of course. Yes. Right. I feel like one of the things about the last few seasons has been the musical score and how it's has sort of underscored the emotional content of some of the scenes and some of the sequences and also kind of the lack of music, if that makes sense. I'm sure that makes sense to you, mm-hmm. but there's been a lot of uses of silence and non-traditional sounding music that almost sounds like sound effects or industrial type scores underneath certain sequences, including some of the action sequences this year. So I feel like that has just, in if nothing else, subliminally contributed to the success of the show for me. What have been some of the standouts for you, if not this last Sunday, in some of the recent episodes musically?
Wow. There's, to me, the thematic material hasn't really changed that much. The medium has changed, especially over the course of from the end of season six to the, you know, to where we are now.
Yeah.
The piano is not a favorite of mine, but I understand why people dig it. It has been used very, very deep in orchestra for other things as far back as season two. But I wasn't a big fan of the introduction of the piano as a front piece. And I know that they were just doing it to make it stand out. I feel like that piece at the beginning of the season finale of season six could have been just as effective if it had been done with the traditional instrumentation. As we've heard, the Light of the Seven theme being done over and over and over again without piano. However, when you look at the way that this newest episode ended with the piano, that did give it a delicacy that I feel was required for us to feel something for Cersei and Jaime. And so in the long run, it's worked out great. That's one of the things that I would like, you know, just the mashup between the Reigns of Castamere and the Light of the Seven. Harmonically, it's not that hard to do. Right. I mean, anybody can take a certain theme and place it over another theme and they can make it work. Bach was doing that back in the 1600s. That's not a big deal. But the whole idea of using it to tell character story, and the two biggest instances where that kind of got deviated in this season were both of Miguel's episodes, both of his episodes. He changed the tone. And I've done a couple of podcasts covering the music of those particular things where the tone was changed, and it was changed, I feel like, on Miguel's request. However, I credit Ramin for the fact that he was still able to interweave it with the themes that we do know in the way that we do know them, or maybe with new variations to create the emotion that totally helped tell the story. And it's, you know, composers are often, especially in film, and I think we had John Del Vento on this podcast not too long ago on the maybe the fan call-in or what have you. He's a composer. He's a professional composer. He does stuff. I've talked to him a couple of times, and he's really bright about that kind of stuff. So he knows what I'm talking about. A lot of times a composer has to either just take the approach that the director gives them and then try and make something work that helps them and helps them tell the story, or use it to help accentuate an emotion or what have you. And I feel like Ramin did that very well if he was given a directive in these. And I don't know for sure. Maybe he just chose to do some of these things. There are a couple of times this season that I've kind of gone, wow, I can hear that behind Westworld.
Yes.
But I don't have a complaint about that because Westworld is still Ramin Djawadi's stamp as an artist. He's still leaving his stamp on whatever series he's doing. I just feel like that they were shocking and they were easy to use repetitively, which in a battle sequence, you you need. But something you brought up, Ken, that I felt was just spot on is where you don't put a score. A good composer knows when to stop. And he let this whole scene with the bells going off, he's building up the music with this somewhat ambient theme, like you were talking about. Yeah. And then as soon as she takes off, bam, it's gone. Now, sometimes that's a director's decision. Sometimes that's a composer's making the suggestion. It's like, this does, you know, let the screams, let the sound effects be the soundtrack. And the guy that used to edit sound for the Star Wars series, Ben Burt, is that his name? I can't remember. He was a sound editor for them. He loved to compose symphonies with the sound bed. You look at the whole episode 2 sequence of them being in that little asteroid field outside of Geonosis. That is a symphony of sound all in itself, and that is all that's required until a certain point where you need to feel like things need to be resolved. And Ramin did that perfectly in this episode as well.
That's great. That's great stuff. I knew that your brain is the brain I wanted to pick about this. I feel like for the most part, I like to not be consciously aware of it. Sometimes you have to be consciously aware of it, depending on what the music is trying to do in a scene and what it's trying to elicit. But for the most part, I love it when it's just a part of the fabric of the scene and I'm not even consciously aware of it.
And yet you are, in a way, subconsciously very aware of it. And that's the beauty of a good film score to me, always has been, where it's not detracting from what you're seeing, but it's making you feel something about it.
Absolutely. Well, I know that you and I spent a lot of time talking about my girl, Sansa, and you and I have not talked about Sansa today. she did not figure at all in last week's episode. She's had some pretty important things to do this season, and of course, last season as well. I love where her character went, or where she is. I always sort of knew where her character was going to go. I didn't know the details, and in some ways, she surpassed where I thought she was going to go. I'm not worried about her humanity at not a lick. I was a little worried about Arya's until last Sunday's episode, mm-hmm. and now I'm not worried about hers either. But what have been your general thoughts about Sansa's arc the last few seasons?
Wow, confronting Littlefinger, was that at the somewhere in season? I guess it was in season 6 before she sent him away and then called the people of the Vale back. I enjoyed that because it depicted Sansa. If you've listened to this podcast for a long time, you know that I, after the Sansa thing in season 5, I was done. I didn't want to see it anymore. Not so much because of the story, but because of the way it was handled by media, by everybody, and how many people were still basically saying, this isn't rape, you know? And I was kind of like, totally is rape. You know, if Dave and Dan had a purpose of demonstrating what rape is, then they failed because nobody seemed to get it. A lot of people did get it. I don't want to discredit people who did. But the whole idea of Sansa's journey from that point, I didn't want it to be about this is what makes her who she is. Who she is, Ken, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, who she is been that from that turning point where she became, I want to be a princess, to I want to get the heck out of here in season 2. Yeah. That was the turning point for Sansa. And she's been on just a great trajectory ever since. She's had terrible things happen to her. And the scene with her and Littlefinger, as I'm trying to get back to, that depicted her not as somebody who came out of it superpowered or whose powers were magnified. She always had that. She learned some stuff from Littlefinger in seasons 3 and 4, but she's always been a survivor. And that is what really continues to have me totally enthralled with Sansa. I have all the love for Sansa. If you hate Sansa, at me.
Right on, buddy. You know, I was talking to Axel before this season began about the fact that I firmly believed and still do that all of the Stark children are safe. And because I feel like there's a mystical thing about them. And I think you get a greater sense of that from the books. The mystical quality of the six Stark children. Well, there's six at the beginning of the story. And so, in some ways, I feel like they're all survivors, right? Like all four who are still alive, and they've all ended up in slightly different emotional places and different logistical places for sure. But the fact that Sansa survived of all of the remaining Starks and all of the Starks in general, it seemed least likely that she would be, quote unquote, the survivor at the beginning of the story. Mm. So the fact that she has survived, you know, is amazing, and it's been inspiring. And Sophie's performance has been phenomenal. You know, you always got the sense right at the beginning that Jon was a reluctant hero and that Arya was a spunky tomboy. And these were archetypes that we've seen before. So the fact that they've survived isn't so surprising.
Right.
But the fact that a girl who claimed that she just wanted to be a princess and was worried about her hairstyle and how she looked and what her dress looked like, that was the fact that she has survived and that and the arc that she's been on has been really special for me and really just kind of personally inspiring in lots of different ways. But it's kind of been a marvel to see. And the other thing I said in that podcast with Axel before the season began is that it wouldn't surprise me if Sansa and or Tyrion ended up in some position of power at the end of this story. Maybe together, maybe separately. But it wouldn't surprise me. And now I haven't seen anything this season that has dissuaded me from that theory. In fact, if anything, I think it's more likely that either Sansa or Tyrion or both of them will end up in some position of power as a resolution or part of the resolution of this story.
Yeah, and I think we've already seen Sansa really assumes a great deal of power. She is the one who the North is looking to now, much more so than Jon Snow,
yeah.
Regardless of who he is. And I know that our friend Stephanie, she's always saying, you know, Sansa, queen in the North. I would love that. but I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I would love that. And I worry a little more for Tyrion, but I think you're right. Sansa is going to end up definitely in some kind of position of power by the end of this episode.
Well, I always feel like she's like Catelyn 2.0. She's like Catelyn and like a lot of Catelyn, a little bit of Littlefinger, a little bit of Cersei, a little bit of Margaery, like all of the people who mentored Sansa, and the same thing with Arya, and really the same thing with all the Stark children. Like Jon had a lot of mentors, Arya had a lot of mentors. So I feel like one of the great things to see over the course of the entire story is how those mentors have shaped the Stark children and led them to where they are right now.
Mm-hmm. The only Stark of the Stark children, the only one that I really mourn is Bran in a lot of ways, because he has lost who he was. And granted, he's probably the most important person in Westeros if you want to look at it from some aspects, but I mourn Bran, especially that scene with him and Tyrion. Yeah. I guess it was the last of the Starks episode where he said, "I mostly live in the past." How sad for that poor kid.
Once again, it's like George turning convention on its ear, because usually in stories like this where someone loses something and then is gifted with extra powers because of that, it's like a total hero's journey and it's a total joyride.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that George has accounted for the responsibility that would lay on someone like Bran and how it would consume someone and maybe eat them from the inside out has been very surprising, but it's also been very provocative. Mm-hmm. And like you, I'm sad. Like, I keep hearing that line reading from the actress who played Mira saying, you know, you died in that cave too. And he did die in that cave. Like, Mira was absolutely correct. The brand that we spent 5 seasons with died in that cave. And now he's something else, something not quite human, even though he still has a human body. So there's definitely a lot to mourn there. You're absolutely right. But like, in a meta point of view, I think it's fantastic that George kind of flipped another convention on its head by showing us, like, what would this really be like if someone attained these sorts of abilities?
Agreed. Totally agreed.
Do you have any, I know you're worried about Tyrion, and I know you're not in the prediction market. And I'm not either, really. I'm just looking forward to the end of the ride next week. Whatever's put in front of me is what I will cry to, because I'm sure I will cry.
Oh yeah, me too.
So I guess I'm looking forward to the end of it. And I guess what's being conveyed to me, so this is what I would ask you, like, the word bittersweet has been thrown around a lot, especially the last year. And I feel like that's been true in everything that we've seen up until now. And I feel like we're going to need a new word, right? Because it's like they're redefining exactly what that term actually means in right. this context. Because I feel like there's going to be a lot more bitter and hopefully some sweet as well next week, and that we're just going to have to deal with a story ending in a truly bittersweet way.
A bitterer sweet, I think is a better way to put it. And that's true. The story of humanity, you look yeah. through history or whatever, it's a sad story. It really is. And why should this be any different? I love the way that sudden deaths, like say a Qyburn death or whatever, is quick. Or even the Jaime and Cersei death was fairly unceremonious. This is real life. You know, these are the things that actually, even if we don't like the way it happened, wake up, folks. That's the way it's going to happen for a lot of people. A lot of people die alone. A lot of people die quickly and didn't ever see it coming. And I do suspect that there will be some more death in this next episode. I don't like it, but I will be mourning. I will be mourning happiness. I'm sure that my tears will be tears of joy and tears of sadness, simultaneously in some cases. But just seeing these characters grow over these last 8 seasons and grow to point to positions that weren't expected. That's another algorithm of life as well. And, for a fantasy story to do this, where, as you've brought up time and time again, the tropes are so heavy and often expected. And I love the fact that we are not getting those tropes. We haven't gotten a single real trope all season. Okay, the Night King died. Well, the Black Hat died. Okay, Cersei died. Well, the Black Hat died. Those may be the two most tropic things. But the way in which they died were so against the trope yeah. that you can't help but just admire this story and the way it's grown, and you can still focus in on these characters and see the way that they've grown, and you can still look at it and say, actually, if I compare this to where I am now and the people I know, you know, it's not that unrealistic. And I love that.
Me too. Like, I didn't need one more second of quote unquote backstory about the Night King. I thought that the way that they dealt with him and that storyline was completely simultaneously surprising, provocative, but also deeply satisfying.
Yes.
And I kind of think it's of this final season as like 2-3 hour ending movies. Cause really the storylines came to a head at the end of last season. And this has all been about resolution, unexpected resolution. How we get there has been unexpected. There have been things that didn't work, play out the way, like you were saying, didn't play out the way we thought they might play out. But it's been all about resolution, like wrapping things up. Like the Night King wasn't going to spend any more time, like trying to convey to people, like why he was so angry and what he wanted. Like he wanted the end of humanity. Bran said it. That's all that needed to be said. And he wasn't going to waste any time. So he attacked. He lost. So he played his hand. He lost his hand. So, I mean, yeah, I love that television. I love that I'm watching a television show that can still surprise me. And even if it negatively surprises me, it still feels ultimately fulfilling.
I totally agree, Ken. I think you put it beautifully there. It's one of these things where, you know, I don't want to psychoanalyze the audience. I really don't. But Stephen King put out a tweet that I read even after I had thought this thought that I loved. It's like people are just angry because the show is ending more so than they're angry about what they're getting. I feel like that may be true. Even if they don't realize it, I feel like that, you know, we're going through a grieving process. This is a show that we've been watching since 2011.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're watching a friend die. And you're going to be mad at the fact that somebody put an IV in here when they shouldn't have. You're going to be mad at all of these things that aren't really about, that you think at the time aren't really about just the fact that you're angry because you're losing this person that you love.
So are you saying, Matt, that some audience members are metaphorically burning down King's Landing with a dragon because they're so angry? So you would think, given that they would be a lot more sympathetic to Danny's turn in last week's episode. Let's talk about that for a second, because and mainly just about Emilia Clarke's performance. Oh my god, it's been so, she hasn't been given a ton of dialogue this year, and in some ways because of that it's felt like she's stepped back a little too, not as much as Lena obviously, but boy, she's done the best face acting. I mean, she's done some amazing face acting.
Yeah,
particularly face acting. And like that moment where she's on the dragon last Sunday night and the bells ring and the camera stays tight on her face for like a 10, 15 seconds. It's all there. Like if you want to look for it, if you're open to being affected by it, Emilia gave you everything in those 10 or 15 seconds. And it was all there on her face.
Yeah. I totally agree. I'll even go back to the episode before Last of the Starks. At the end of that episode, I'm sure that a lot of people were thinking, just by Emilia's fantastic acting as they're following her when she's walking away, they're thinking, she's just going to get on a dragon and burn them all up right now.
Yeah.
I love that they took a moment to pause so that we could get the very story, so that we could get Tyrion and Jaime, so that we could get these things that are also very, very important. But you put that last shot of Last of the Starks and this shot of her when she's on the ramparts listening to the bells ring. You edit those together and you see one continuous stream of what is happening to Daenerys. And like you said, you don't need anything else to tell you. You don't need her to say, I'm going to kill them all. You don't need to see another shot of her after she takes off. We don't see her again. We just see the belly of the dragon. You don't need her screaming at the masses or anything like that, just to know that this emotional trauma that has been building up for Dany essentially since she arrived at Winterfell, and coupled with the fact that now she's lost key advisors who might be able to rein her back when they couldn't rein her back, or when they could rein her back before, that we've seen in earlier seasons. You put all of that together, and this journey is one of the most beautiful, albeit tragic, and albeit shocking, and like you often use the word provocative, it's shocking and provocative, but man, is it some of the best acting and television that I've seen in a long, 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 long time.
Well, you know what that those two facial expressions that you were just referencing, they reminded me of two facial expressions she made in season one. The one where she's right in the pilot after Viserys talks to her for the first time and sort of sexually assaults her. Mm-hmm. And we're like, ew, because her brother and sister. And she has a look on her face when she's getting into the hot water and the handmaiden's like, oh, the water's too hot. And she has like a dead inside look on her face.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on in the season, when Viserys is getting gold poured on his head, mm-hmm. and Jorah's instinct is like, come, Khaleesi, you don't have to look at this, and it's your brother. And she's just like, once again, like that dead inside, wide stare, looking at the death of the only family she's ever known, the person who raised her. Not only was he a brother to her, but he had to have been a surrogate father, since he is the person who raised her from birth.
That's a horrifying thing to think about, Ken, actually.
Well, that was actually going to be my next point, is I think we forget, like I forget, maybe lots of people forget, how much trauma this girl has really been through. The fact that she was raised by Viserys Targaryen and more than likely periodically sexually assaulted by him, which mm-hmm. is alluded to more in the books than in the TV show. If that's where her life started, and then she was sold into slavery, sold into marriage / slavery, everything that we've seen happen to her since the pilot, there was a lot that had happened to her before the pilot. So she's lived a life of trauma, mm-hmm. and I think sometimes that's easy to forget about her character.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And I know that many times in the past, I've forgotten about that. Either in times when I've said, see, Drogon left her because she's no good. Because she's no good at ruling. Or times when I've said, it's like, wow, I can't believe that she did that. That's so cool. Either way, it's easy to lose what's at the heart of a character, like you just pointed out. I mean, there's a whole... No matter what age you want to put Dany at, if she was 16 at that time or what have you, or 13, or if, I think it's more like 13 in the books and several yeah. years later in the show. But she's experienced that whole lifetime of agony, yeah. running for her life.
Yes.
You know, being, like you said, like being Viserys. these are all things that are easy to see how they would culminate in the fact that she gets down to a choice with her and John, and she says, I'll never be loved here.
Yeah.
I'll only be feared here. And she's looking for, and I guess if Axel wants to blame John for this, even though he's not really directly responsible, he can't help how he was brought up. She's throwing a lifeline, or asking John to throw her a lifeline. Just let me be loved. And it's clear that even he can't love her anymore, not in the way that she wanted him to. There's such despair in that. Yeah.
Well, it's like, it's all of that. And then you throw in the fact that she's a messianic figure. Mm. And being a messianic figure is a double-edged sword. Like, to me, that cuts both ways. Like, you can do a lot of good as a messianic figure, which mm-hmm. obviously Daenerys has done. She freed all of those slaves in Slaver's Bay. She's done a lot of good for people. But the downside of being a messianic figure is that that's a lot of power to be contained in one little person, and there's a lot of, I mean, that can really fuck with your head in lots of ways. Like, sometimes I mean, not to get super religious-y, but like, what would have happened to someone like Jesus had he not gone when he did. I'm not trying to be purposely provocative, but I'm just trying to say there's lots of people with power, and sometimes that power can morph if you live long enough. And for Dani, her power is both her saving grace and the yoke that she wears around her head, around her neck.
I totally agree. As I think I said in the initial reaction, but I'm not sure. I know I said it on my podcast. Here you have all of these circumstances that you just discussed on top of all of the trauma that we discussed earlier. And she's got her finger on a nuclear button, more or less. This is what happens. She's human. And I'm not trying to excuse it. I cannot. There's no way we can justify what we did. It was horrific. It was terrible.
Yeah.
And such. But like you said, a messianic figure with, I love that word, a messianic figure with all of this power, but is still human. I mean, just because she has this power doesn't make her divine.
Yeah.
And that's the true telling is like, if I was the only guy in the world, and I'm going to pick on Donald here for a second. If I was the only guy in the world who had a nuclear bomb and it was pointed at Donald's house, last night on Twitter, I would have pushed the button.
Oh boy.
Well, then the other thing is power doesn't make up for an empty heart or a hole in your heart, right? And I think that's one of the things that George is trying to teach us in this story is that Dani ultimately wants to be loved. And that has nothing to do with power or sitting on the Iron Throne or ruling the Seven Kingdoms. She was robbed with love from the day she was born because her mother died and most of her family died. Mm-hmm. And she was raised by a sociopathic brother. And then she's had all these horrible experiences since then. So it's the same thing with Cersei, right? Like she lost her mother and she was raised by a cold, distant father. And she wasn't able to live the life she wanted with the man she wanted openly. And so I think sometimes people in this story are pursuing power in lieu of the hole in their heart. And I think what they're realizing is one thing doesn't address the other.
Yeah. Well, we see that in the real world, don't we, Ken?
Absolutely.
That's the truth, right? That's the truth. It's like even when my son says to me, "Hey, why was this person mean to me, Daddy?" The thing I say is probably because they wanted to be loved. They were feeling like they were unloved. They were having a lack of compassion. They were hurt. They were open to emotion, you know? And that's what I think we see. I was listening in while you were talking there about Dani being a messianic figure. And that's something that I've been saying, Ken, is that this story has kind of become, and we see coming into this season so much of the White Walkers about the gods and the monsters, right?
Yeah. Where
it's a Greek tragedy. We see the little people here with the Arya and what Dani does to them. But then even cinematically, once Dani leaves that perch, we never see her face again.
Yeah.
Because she is no longer a human character. She is the dragon. She is the might of the gods.
Yeah.
And when we consider her emotions and her feelings, whether it's online, in real life, what have you, thinking about this as a story, as a mythology, that is what she always has been. I mean, she can walk into fire. She's fireproof. She has dragons. She comes from a long line, I guess. Being the one book that I have read is Fire and Blood, it surprised me the least. And I think a lot, you know, that she would make this turn because that's kind of what's inside of her, you know? And it may be a part of the story too is, certain parts of ourselves, like we were talking about with Jamie, are undeniable. They're unchanged. We can't control them. We can try as we might to have to give a character or a story or ourselves agency over our own lives and actions. But in a lot of situations, we're not in control.
And the only thing I would add to that, those brilliant points, Axel, is that she is not her brother or her father. So the fact that she still indulges in her worst instincts makes it even more tragic and sad. Mm-hmm. Because had Viserys done that, then it wouldn't have meant much. And we already know that her father did that. So the fact that she did that, given that we know what she's positively capable of, makes it even more sad and tragic. So,
yeah, totally agreed.
Ooh.
Let's talk. The only thing that I wanted to bring up was Clegane Bowl.
Yes.
Okay.
I was thinking that the mount, like to me, when in the middle of that sequence, I thought about a really old sequel that is one of the rare handful of sequels that most people think is better than the original, which is, and in this case, the sequel is The Bride of Frankenstein, which is a sequel to Frankenstein, both written and directed by a man named Frank Wally. And I thought about The Bride of Frankenstein when I was watching Clegane Bowl, because that movie ends with two monsters fighting and ultimately destroying each other and the castle around them. And so I was thinking about that because I thought the mountain was obviously born a monster. But when he was 12 or so, he created a monster in his little brother by shoving his face in the fire. And so when they met up again on that staircase, they were both monsters. One had been created a monster. The other one was born a monster. And so I was thinking about that as they were fighting and how sadly beautiful it was that two monsters were fighting each other and killing each other. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on that.
I think that's beautiful, Ken. And I think it plays right into you bring up The Bride of Frankenstein and I've said of gods and monsters, and you know, that's a movie about the making of one of those movies, I think, actually. Yeah. So it's along those same mythological lines of them being able to not being able to escape their story, right?
Yeah.
And their tragic flaws too. And the Hound, I was never a fan of Clegane Bowl. I've said it, and then people had, like yourself, others have had good thoughts of saying to me, "Well, hey, it's not just about the fighting," and also that I kind of have to accept that the Hound. Matt and I talked about this, that the Hound is that character, that is who he is. Whether or not I want him to be a cuddly, nice guy, the most he's going to get is a Sandor thank you. That's what we're going to get, you know, and we got that. And I was happy with that. And upon rewatch, I really liked the Clegane Bowl a lot more. And the aspects you're saying is some of the things that I was not able to conceptualize. But as you say them, they become real to me, and they were just these two monsters fighting, and then they go, the castle's falling, they go into the fire. There was something so classic about it and beautiful and tragic. And I was really kind of taken with it. And just that no matter what he did, he couldn't kill him. He wasn't even fighting his brother. He was fighting himself, right? He was all of us fighting our demons and our things that we can't let go of. The anger that we can't let go of is what he was fighting. Because it's funny too, that with all of the varied issues that people may have with the show, I haven't heard many people say come on, he took a knife to the skull and he still lived. Right? Like, nobody's complaining right. about that because he's a monster. You know? Like, we just accept that. So yeah. that's kind of beautiful. What say you, Matt?
Well, first of all, I shamefully admit I've not seen any of those three films. Second of all, I feel like that I can't really express anything more than what you guys said. Maybe the only caveat that I could add is that that scene's conclusion was made wonderfully, poetically, sad and happy. Made me feel happy for both of those characters, really, because they met their end thanks to the score. It's a very subtle score, probably will never, ever be repeated again. It made perfect sense for the end of those two characters.
Yes, absolutely. Hear, hear. Yes.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, guys, we've been going for a while here, about an hour and a half. I did have to leave just there for a second, but that actually gives me a podcast to listen to. So it might, maybe it'll take me longer to edit this because I'll just listen to everything. But before we go, and I want, if anyone has anything else they want to bring up, but I don't know if you particularly talked about it. We've kind of talked about it throughout, but I would like to hear what you all think, what you may want to happen, or what kind of, like, just a, it doesn't have to be a prediction, or just kind of what you're looking for in this episode, or how you're feeling, just kind of a concluding remark. And I'll give mine, but I'll let you start, Matt.
Oh, well, thank you for alleviating me from the responsibility of a prediction, because yes, no, no, not only do not only do I not like them, but I'm really bad at them. So that's a good thing for everybody listening. The whole idea that I have about this, what I want is a story that will finish in a way that will surprise me and make me cry. And I can't be any more specific than that in terms of character, what have you. That's what I want. And that's what I feel like I'm going to get. So I'm really looking forward. I'm going to be mourning this show for a long time because it's been my, you know, a big part of every emotion imaginable to feel, from hate to love to sadness to happiness to, you know, fist pumping to fist shaking. All of it has been encapsulated in following these characters. So as long as the show just surprises me one last time and makes me feel like it's concluded, then I'll be very happy.
That's awesome. That's a great way of putting it. Ken, what say you?
Very, very similar to what Matt just said. I feel like I'm in good hands. I feel like I'm going to cry a lot, both happy tears and sad tears, hopefully. I feel like it's going to make emotional sense to me. And once again, I don't know what the details are going to be, but I trust that I'm going to feel that there is a conclusion that makes emotional sense to me, because I do feel like I'm in good hands. And I look forward to a few more intimate conversations between two or three people. And I look forward to saying goodbye to something, like Matt just so eloquently said, like, that has also meant a lot to me, so much so that I felt compelled to call into a podcast show, which I had never done before, but I love the show so much that I'm like, I've got to talk to people about the show. And so I called into Matt's show one Monday night, and the rest is sort of history.
That's so awesome.
So I look forward to the end of the journey, and I think I'll be happy, sad, satisfied, but also I'll mourn that it's over. But you know, this is what life's about, right? Like, having these experiences with people, with places, with things, like stories. That's what life should be about, like being open enough to letting things like this television show affect us. So I look forward to it affecting me one more time.
That is beautiful, Ken. I'm going to save my predictions. I think we might jump on and do like a little live stream on Sunday with Tim, maybe Justin. You all are invited if you like. I mean, we'll just get on and talk because we're all going to be so excited. I figure I might just do that. So I'll save the predictions, but I'm just with both of you. I'm preparing myself just for, whoa, my, what the holy, no, no, just emotions. And I'm just going to roll with it. And I really, this season, I think I've done a really good, you know, Matt, you'd be proud of me because for all my crazy predictions, I really was a good practicer of non-attachment this season. And
oh, good.
No matter what went, I was wrong about, I just didn't care. I didn't care. I had crazy ideas. Ice Queens and Cersei and this, but I just didn't care when it happened in the show. It was just about sharing and talking. And though I will admit other seasons, I have gotten a little bit fixated because I'm slightly obsessive because you called into a podcast, Ken, and so did I. And then I made podcasts and the rest is history there. We all have our own obsessions.
I feel like that as far as any of my experience with y'all in any kind of podcasting where you might have called into the show here, it probably was more or less just you guys thinking, man, that guy's so far off. I've got to send him straight.
No,
get out of here. You know, and Bubba as well, our friend from the Joffrey podcast. I love that guy. We've had a great, wonderful journey. And I feel privileged to have talked to great minds throughout the course of it, minds like yourself. Thanks for having me on today.
Oh, nope, dude. It will continue. That's the thing is, you know, love or hate the show, the thing that I always think about is the old law statement, we made this together, and this is our sideways, people. We all made this community together. And whether you're upset or happy or indifferent, you're still a part of it. And that's the kind of magical part and being able to do. I mean, I feel like we could go on for like 8 hours. I mean, I feel like we just started and we're like an hour something into this. But I just am looking forward to a great episode, to a lot of spectacle, a lot of, like Ken said, I think we're going to get a fair amount of just maneuvering. You know, people are in trouble. And I don't know. I just feel like it might be a lot of talking while Danny is sequestered in a room with Grey Worm standing in front of the door. And we just going to have to figure out what our characters are really going to do because it's sad the place they've come to at this point, which should be a joyous occasion, right? They won. They defeated all the bad guys and gals. Mm. But unfortunately, they ain't so happy. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but I know that even though this is the final episode, we're going to keep on talking about it. And like I say, you all know, I mean, there's going to be prequels and sequels and like, this is AT&T bought Time Warner for a reason. Game of Thrones was part of that reason. Trust me when they're sitting in a boardroom. So
exactly, Axel.
Yeah.
I let me just say this, you know, the George R. Martin started this whole thing back, what, Ken, 1996?
Yeah.
And people are still coming up with new podcasts and new perspectives on book one. You know, so we will be talking about this series for a long, 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 long time.
Definitely. Absolutely. Definitely. So, Ken, Matt, thank you so much for coming on. We're going to do this again. I look forward to it. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Matt, you can find everyone at Matt's audio blog, right, Matt?
Matt's GOT blog on Twitter, mattsaudioblog.com. Thanks.
There you go. Appreciate and that. You can find Ken in your heart because he's always there. He's in mine too.
That's right.
We love you all. Check us out, podcastwinterfell.com on the Twitter and all that. Enjoy the show. We'll be back sooner than you think. Peace out, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.